Good evening. Thank you for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. It's a little bit past 6 p.m. on December 16th, and this is In the Motherhood. I'm your host, Robin Fadden, tonight. And on today's In the Motherhood, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had back in August, and now we're going to talk again about the same thing. And what the same thing is schooling during the COVID pandemic. So I'm talking with fellow parents Tracy and Gina about what they did for schooling during the pandemic in the past few months, and we talk about our thoughts on how it's going personally for us and our kids, as well as how the provincial government has handled it. And we have mixed feelings about that, of course. Not really so mixed, more negative, but we have our reasons about it, and we know that there are many different feelings out there about how the government has handled the pandemic and the many aspects of the pandemic. And what we're talking about here is how they've handled schooling and education, and how teachers feel about that as well, because Tracy and Gina are both teachers. So I'm going to play that part of the conversation first. And after that conversation, we're going to hear a bit of a lighter topic. We're going to hear all about Bach Before Bedtime's Montreal Made the Nutcracker. And Bach Before Bedtime is a Montreal music concert group that creates chamber music productions for children and families. And so they've created a 30-minute virtual holiday chamber music and dance production of Tchaikovsky's timeless classic, The Nutcracker, and it's made for all ages, and you can download it at Bach Before Bedtime's website and get it for yourself. It's $15, but you're going to hear all about it in the second part of the show. That's a little bit after around 6:40 p.m. You'll hear about Bach Before Bedtime, but in the meantime, you can go to the Bach Before Bedtime website and check out the trailer for that production. So thank you for listening to In the Motherhood here on CKUT 90.3 FM, and we'll get into this conversation about schooling during the COVID pandemic. So I'm speaking with Tracy and Gina about what's going on with schooling in the province of Quebec right now, but specifically what's going on with them and their children. Thanks for joining me again, Tracy and Gina. We spoke back in August, shortly before the school year was about to begin. And at that time, I was on the fence about sending my kid back to grade one, and he'd gone to kindergarten at that school. And I was really on the fence, and I was thinking about homeschooling. And we did decide to send him to school. And we'll talk a little bit about what happened. It's been overall good. There have just been a lot of added stresses this semester. And so I wanted to start with you, and we'll get to me in the process of the conversation. But what did back to school, however you chose to do it, look like for you? Go ahead, Tracy.
Back to school for me, let's put myself back end of August, beginning of September. I started a new job. I was shifted away from teaching in the classroom and to consulting with an Indigenous organization for their teachers to help get them online for distance learning. And back to school, I knew that I did not want to necessarily send Jack into the classroom. That's why I stepped away from the classroom myself. And part of it was I just anticipated all of the up and down of emotions, the roller coaster of emotions that I had experienced in the spring. And I did not want to live that again. Are schools opening? Are they closed? Am I going to have to switch to this? Am I going to have to take time off work in case his school shuts or whatever? So what I decided, first, I was holding out for online, like the virtual school, because there was a case in front of the courts to allow all people access to virtual school to have the choice. Well, back then and now, only children who themselves or people in their families that live in the same at the same address as them, if they have grave medical illnesses, they are allowed to have virtual schooling, but no one else. And so September 8th, I remember, was the day that we found out that no, the courts were not going to force access to virtual learning to students. So that was the day that I decided to homeschool Jack, that I put in my official notice that I would be homeschooling him. And so here I am, homeschooling and working full time.
I'm interested in what you said about making this choice, partly because of if you put him in school, whether there would be stoppage of school, what would happen? Like, at least in this situation, you could make your own schedule.
Well, that was it. No matter what happened, whether schools closed, whether there was an outbreak in his school, whatever, no matter what happened, our situation would stay the same. It's ridiculous a little bit, but at least it's the same. I don't have that constant feeling of what's going to happen tomorrow. I have a friend who has 2 children in elementary school. His daughter had to stay home for 10 days because there was an outbreak in her class. The evening before she was set to go back, he got a letter saying his son now had to stay home for 10 days. So he had to juggle his schedule and he finally thought, okay, we'll go back to normal tomorrow. And it wasn't. So I'm very thankful that I made this decision so that regardless, whatever happens, my life, our lives won't be impacted in the same way.
Yeah, we had a similar thing happen to your friend where we had about a month and a half ago, there was a case in my kid's class. And so they were all the kids in his class were home for 2 weeks. And then about 10 days to 2 weeks passed and there was another case. And I had just gotten caught up on my work. It was that kind of a situation where I had, and even with 2 parents working from home, it was still really difficult to get acquainted with the online learning, the virtual platform, which wasn't it's not an all day situation. This is like a half an hour here, half an hour there, get on the iPad. Thankfully we have an extra computer or a tablet. Just like the adjustment to that was kind of extreme, even though I'm a pretty technologically inclined person. It's more about my kid and his adjustment to that and my adjustment to what happens in my work day. So yeah, I was kind of regretting my decision, but the first couple of months of school had been really great. There was added stress. Lots of kids were wearing masks in his class, however. We'll just go to Gina now. And Gina, how was your back to school? What did that look like for you?
I guess it unfurled a lot like I expected it to in terms of the number of cases that started to appear in schools. I have twins who are 13 years old just recently. And I was too worried about being at risk myself. If they were going to school and then also living between my dad, their dads and my house, we were going to have children in 6 different institutions. So we would have a daycare, 2 elementary schools and 2 high schools movement. And so I negotiated with their father over the summer because I said I would be happy to homeschool them or to find an alternative in some way. Or he would have to accept temporary custody of them because I was not going to be sending my younger children to school. And so he agreed and we had a 3-month provisional agreement, which we've since had to renew and we're kind of renewing it month by month at this point. They're very happy. They just started high school. So they're loving the social aspect of things. And certainly I felt a lot easier about the situation once the masks were mandated in the classroom. Although then they were texting me saying there's police officers at the entrances of the schools marking them to have their masks on. And they were always pretty happily mask compliant. So they're loving it. But at the same time, they're in programs like one of my daughters is in a basketball program and she can't play basketball really now. So the main motivator for her in school is kind of gone. I get a late notice almost every day for her. I don't have much control over it because she's not living with me. Both of my daughter's schools, I get notices at least every 2 days. Both of them have had over 20 cases. One of them had a mobile clinic installed in the parking lot to test 1,000 students. We have not been notified that it's happened in their classes, but it is terrifying. I had to withdraw my 7-year-old from her alternative school. We were so pleased that she won the lottery to be in that school. I've had to withdraw my daughter from my toddler from the best daycare that I've ever found. And they actually, I didn't bring her back as of August. I tried a week in the summer and we got sick. I was talking to you, I think, after that. Her daycare had a massive outbreak in October and there were 12 infections and most of them were in her group. So I'm feeling like I'm in the right and I did the right thing, but I'm feeling like everyone is still kind of treating me like I'm being paranoid because of policy. And it's been really taxing trying to work full time and teach online while taking care of these young children.
Yes. And we hear your kid in the background.
I'm going to have some stopgap childcare, but she's no one else can breastfeed her. So it's a thing.
The realities of parenting during a pandemic.
Oh, it's a similar thing. I'm working full time, and like there's this constant, you know, Gina has the physically on her, and I have a dog that barks. Like I am never fully in my work. I feel like I actually said this to my son the other day. Yes, you could eat that. Sorry. That I am never fully present in anything I do. You know, that I feel like sometimes, you know, a bad mother, a bad worker, bad facilitator or whatever, because there's always part of my mind that's thinking about something else, because I'm always there's part of me that is physically doing something else at all times, you know. And one thing that we've started to use that kind of helps things is we have a shared Google Calendar, so he can see when I'm blocked off. Like I block off, I am in a video conference now. This one, he knows it's not for work, so he knew it was okay to kind of run in and say, can I eat this? You know, but when it's for work, like, and I'll tell him, this one you really can't come, or this one it's okay, it's just with so-and-so, you know. And but there's this constant plurality of work, this multitasking that we know that multitasking is not a good thing. Like you don't put all of yourself into whatever you're doing. So work, you know, my job is supporting teachers who are shifting to online learning. And there, I also feel their stress. It's very difficult for them, for some of them. So there's a lot of different things to manage throughout the day. It affects everyone on so many levels, at so many levels, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a student, whether you're a parent, whether you're in a partnership with someone or not. You know, there's just different ways that it affects everybody. And I think in our last time that we spoke, I spoke of this resentment I have towards the government. It's still very much there, especially like a couple of weeks ago when there was this new directive for teachers. You know, I guess parents had complained when students were home awaiting test results that their students weren't being followed up. So he said, well, now the teachers will have to provide work for the students who are missing from school. And I just thought, you know, just add it on to the teacher's workload. Now the teachers will have to do this. There's no problem. But I know teachers who have like rotating door in their classroom of who is not there and who is there. And there could be 8 to 10 students on any given day who are absent. And what work do you give them? It's not like,
it's interesting to hear from you, you know, about what is going on with the teachers that you're trying to support. I have mad respect for all the teachers, of course, and that same kind of frustration with the government, and especially about what is being left unsaid about whether teachers are being supported, how they feel. So much is not being talked about. And as a parent, that worries me, because I worry about how teachers are feeling, because that's, our kids feel that too. Our kids feel teachers' stress. When we did speak back at the end of August, none of us were very satisfied. There was a lot of unknown, right? And that unknown is still going on. And have you encountered any difficulties related to like the provincial government management of the pandemic in terms of homeschooling, in terms of schooling? You spoke a bit about cases in your classes, but has it affected homeschooling for you, Tracy, or for you, Gina?
It's been really challenging for my daughter to maintain her French at any sort of level. I guess it's the hardest thing for us. And I actually enrolled her in an expensive online French course, which I was privileged to be able to do. But it was like pulling teeth every week to get her into this little Zoom classroom of just 4 kids for some personalized instructions. I have curriculum books for second grade in English and in French. And just trying to like negotiate with her to do a little bit of that is just awful, because I'm mom and I also have, you know, a 2-year-old who is like always here, and who has, we were, before our recording started, we were talking about like disrupted sleep and stuff. And so I'm pretty irritable, and it really resonated with me actually what Tracy said. And this is not so much about the government, but just the way that I just feel, I guess, like I'm a, you know, as a teacher, I'm a government employee. I feel like I'm bad at everything. I feel like I'm never mentally present enough to be with my kids. I'm never really mentally present enough to be with my students. And I cherish the aspect of myself as a teacher who is concerned about her students and who wants to help them. But it's been too much. I do feel very much betrayed by the government. I don't think I'll ever get over this betrayal. It's been the waffling on policy and the lack of seriousness about mask wearing, the opening schools without having a mask policy, the way that they prioritize bars and restaurants and things over student health, the way that they're still prioritizing shopping. Like, I can't even imagine. I hate what they did about the Christmas prioritization that they later reneged on anyway, but I feel like they could be paying people in the service industry to stay home. You know, there should be a lot more support for people. There should be a lot more support for parents. I mean, I was one of the earlier mask wearers, and it wasn't so much about just going outside and seeing people not wearing masks. It was being berated by people for wearing a mask. It was being made fun of and belittled and harassed. Coming home from the Dep in tears because I was told that I was sick and part of the problem. There's only so much the government can control that, but I think that their part in it is very clear.
They are giving the message out, and then the media is reporting on those messages. They are definitely a part of that, of people's public attitude towards mask wearing, towards the virus, towards COVID itself. You know, the stress of it all, the worry, the unknown factors, and then the reality coming to the fore. It's like, okay, this did happen. There are cases. We have been tested 4 times since the end of August, since September, and negative every time, but there's still that worry every time you go get tested. And we go get tested because, and this is sort of one of my frustrations with the provincial government and the Santé Publique, is that the letters that they send when there's a case in a kid's class, none of the letters have hard language about go get tested. It's, we recommend that your child go get tested. And in my mind, as trying to be a responsible citizen and everything I've read and, you know, and epidemiologists I've spoken to for that matter say, well, the whole family should be going to get tested, shouldn't they? And that is not being encouraged from everything that I'm reading, including letters directly to us as parents. And I am hearing that not all kids are going to get tested.
I got so frustrated with this yesterday. It's actually on the Quebec COVID page. Mm-hmm. It's not recommended. It says a child may go get tested. Because a friend of mine wrote to me yesterday saying, I have a situation, I need your advice. Because, you know, like I follow it very closely, partly for work and partly just because I follow it closely. There's two houses, like he and his ex-wife in two different houses. And in one case, his daughter was staying with was living mainly with the ex-wife, but not always. Something about the daughter's boyfriend's brother was tested positive. Should the daughter go to school? You know, and it's like, well, they're living in the same house at one point. The actual official policy is, yeah, they can go to school. They just need to monitor.
And then there's another letter that comes home or a phone call that I get about another case in the class, you know, with just like one after the other. And of course, we don't know where these cases are coming from. We don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. But just knowing that testing is not being encouraged and contact tracing seems pretty lax as well. This is one of my personal frustrations. And I tried to let it go at the beginning of the school year. I thought, okay, I'm just going to have faith in the system. And that didn't work out, right? My frustration remains, and you know, I can write all the letters I want, but I think having conversations like this with each other that recognize that our feelings about this and everything we read about it aren't overboard, especially when I see like the outcome is there are cases in elementary schools when back in August they were like, well, children don't really pass the virus on.
If you look at the data, you can see it's almost to the day, 2 weeks after the French schools opened, there was a huge uptick in cases. And then 3 days later, which would be 2 weeks after the English schools opened, another uptick in cases. You know, so it's obvious. And I think it comes down to this wishy-washiness of our government. Like even today, Paul Arcand interviewed the premier, and now we started talking about how a possibility of allowing outdoor gatherings for Christmas. You know, so there's another like, yes, you can gather, but only for the 4 days. And oh, you know, if you celebrate something else, just celebrate at Christmas time. What's the big deal? And then no gatherings. And now, well, maybe you can do some outdoor gatherings, but not in your backyard because people might want to use your bathroom. Like, you know, it's just
this like ridiculousness. Just look at the numbers, the spread that's happening, and say, you know what? It sucks, but we just need to stay home.
Sorry, I was reading an article recently about like how some people who believe they are, you know, doing right will, you know, they'll follow the mandates of the governments. And so if the mall is open, they assume the mall has been deemed low enough risk.
Yeah.
And fully intelligent and kind people that I know seem to operate on a similar principle. And I think that part of it is like, well, if the kids are in schools and the schools are okay. Yeah. You're getting some insight into how distracted my classes have been. Yes. If the schools are open, you know, and if the malls are open, then why can't I have people over at my house? And why can't we do this and that and something else? And
absolutely. I think that's what we mean when we say muddled messaging. The messaging doesn't have to, the government can say these things, don't do that. But when people are going shopping, when people are doing this, it's very easy in our minds as human beings to make a case for doing the thing we want to do. And a lot of journalists are saying this, a lot of psychologists are saying this, and that's just how we function as human beings. We also function socially, and that's part of our stress right now, is that we're not getting to do that. And so I understand completely why people convince themselves that it's okay to go out for one last drink, or it's okay to have a tiny gathering. Yet at the same time, I would love it if our government would say, don't do that. The cases are increasing. More people are getting more severely sick. More hospital beds are unavailable to anybody who might have something else that they need to go to hospital for. All of these messages to me would give me more faith in this government, perhaps more faith in this government, perhaps, maybe just a tiny bit. Every day I hope, maybe the messaging will change as the cases rise, and then it doesn't. And then we get this kind of waffling, like, well, maybe you can have an outdoor gathering.
At the beginning of this school year, the education minister, Roberge, insisted that as soon as a school, as soon as there needs to be a shutdown or something, not to worry, there'll be a 24-hour turnaround. We will immediately be online. But meanwhile, they're not, you know, and so that's when I guess he jumped in and said, well, now anytime anyone stays home, teachers have to send home work or whatever. But look at like the end of this week, and the elementary schools are not going online. I read what's going to happen, and it said assignments at home with daily direct contact. That can absolutely be translated into package gets sent home and teacher sends an email off to the class. That's direct contact. And so each school is going to be dealing with that differently, but that's not online learning. That's nothing. That is, I don't know how many people are going to actually do this package of work that's going to be sent home, you know, because it's just not going to get done. So a lot of time and energy and money was put into creating those backup plans, but they're not being used. And for me, it's like, it's such a disrespect of teachers. Like that's just been added over and over throughout this whole thing that, schools and you know, the school boards have to give in these plans. Well, it's not someone at the school board who comes up with the plan. The school board sends a notice out to all the principals and says, your school needs to come up with a plan. You know, so it's the teachers who come up with the plan. So there's that planning. And then this extra planning for students who are going to be home. And then there's this extra this. And also make sure you keep your room clean. I have a friend who's, I don't know if she's going to last till the end of the year. She teaches at a high school and she has like 6 or 7 different sections, and she has to go to each of the rooms, and she's teaching online at the same time as she's teaching kids in the classroom in front of her. So she's teaching in 2 different spaces at the same time, actually multiple spaces, because each student is beaming in from somewhere else, right? And plus the students in front of her. And don't forget, you have to clean and disinfect everything when you enter and when you leave. And God forbid someone gets sick. There's going to always be that feeling, did I not clean it properly? Am I not practicing? You know, it's just so many layers of disrespect for the teacher. And I work in adult education. And in the spring, I don't know if you remember the report cards, there were no final exams, right? In the elementary schools and in the high schools. It was all a teacher professional judgment as to what the final mark would be, not an adult education. The students had to come in and do exams because the teachers were not given that same professional respect or whatever, that no, it's okay, we trust your judgment, you know, they had to write their final exams. So there's just this inconsistent trust of the teachers and the teaching profession and the school communities, and inconsistent messaging. Like, I'm, you know, Gina, like, not, and homeschooling, forget about it, like that's a whole other layer. Like, you know, like, we have to apply the QEP, like what the Quebec education program. So how is this really homeschooling? Like, we still need to tick off very specific boxes. And starting next year, I believe the students who are homeschooled will have to do provincial exams, I guess, at a school. I don't know how that logistically, how that'll work. I have such resentment right now towards the government in terms of how they treat teachers, how they're treating schools, how they're treating parents, how they're treating homeschoolers. It's, and just the public. Like you said, people, both of you said, there are people who really think they're doing the right thing because they're following this wishy-washiness.
Just so much agreement with everything Tracy said. I was going to say too, like, the public resentment of teachers as well. Like, obviously not from everyone, but I was noticing in a group about education in Quebec on Facebook where someone posted, there was like a, and just kind of talking about how taxed teachers are. And someone weighed in of like, they can't just answer that one email from that student because of the, all that invisible labor that's part of teaching. And so, yeah, when you have a government that so blatantly disrespects teachers, it's not helping public misunderstanding about what's involved with teaching. I'm lucky because I teach for an institution that is remote. So, so that, you know, it was ironic for me to be like, oh, I'm going to stay home for everyone's protection, but then my kids can go to six different daycares and schools, you know, or my kids and my, you know, the half siblings of my kids. But yeah, so I just, yeah, the wishy-washiness and the public sentiment, both in terms of like mask wearers and people who think they're doing the right thing, and also just like the way that we're not being kinder to teachers right now. And I see a lot of stuff about like, oh, students are having it really hard, why can't teachers be more understanding? And it's just like, teachers only have so many hours in a day, and they have families of their own in a lot of cases, and they only have so much emotional resources upon which to draw to be able to, you know, to deal with that sort of thing.
And one of my worries coming up as we exit December and then go into another term of school is, what are things going to look like in the next 4 months over winter as we get much deeper into not being able to go outside on every single day, because there are going to be minus 25 days when nobody, no child wants to leave the house, let alone me as a parent.
Or where the schools where they have to leave the windows open because yeah, the ventilation isn't great. And you know, it's the winter is hard in a good year. It's hard to imagine what's coming. And another thing I wanted to add about homeschooling and just actually about education in general, I think that our government has actually really shot itself in its feet, or whatever, if that expression translates into a kind of an entity, by not offering online distance education for parents who can. Like, I work from home. It'd be much easier for me not to have to also plan out the curriculum and just say, you know what, Jack, you need to do this. There are now, I think at the end of last year, there was roughly 6,000 people homeschooling, like in June. At this point, we're well over 12,000 families or 12,000 students who are homeschooling. I had to submit a learning plan for my child. It had to be done within 30 days of me pulling him out of school, which I did. So that was September 8th. I had done it, but I did it around October 1st. I still do not have a resource person assigned to me. Right? So there's nobody following me. There's no one tracking me. And I'm sure I am not the only person that doesn't have someone, especially like, and there are people who are still pulling students. They're pulling their children out still, you know, like it's not like it all happened in September. It's going to happen until the end of the year. So I still don't have someone following me. If I had been given that option of, they have classes set up at the school boards. There are teachers who quit. I left teaching because I did not want to go back into the classroom in this mess. I know many teachers who retired early because of this, who left the profession because of it. And if they had offered online positions, we would have stayed. I would have stayed if I was teaching online, for sure, 100%.
I feel like the studies about the economic fallout of this that are going to be continuing for the next couple of decades are going to show exactly this, like how has this affected working parents? How has this affected people's job choices? And yeah, early retirement.
Women or job choices.
Yes, and women in particular. We've already seen many articles and many data-based articles about this and the effect. And I mean, even just looking at how far I fell behind in my own work over the course of 2 weeks of virtual learning. And I think about, yeah, the people who have, you know, and who have chosen to homeschool and not received any kind of support, any resource person. And yeah, how that affects their working lives, but also their health, their mental health, their ability to focus. And also one of the things that I've been thinking about too is all of the community-based initiatives that I've been a part of, for instance, and that I haven't been able to give my attention to during this time, when my attention has become far more scattered and my work has changed and the schooling has changed. So I feel like there's that loss too. I'm not doing the volunteer work that I usually do. I'm not able to focus on certain projects that are volunteer based. And so I'm just thinking about all of the different kinds of losses that are happening that aren't being addressed by this current government's, you know, apparent address on the economic, apparent addressing of economic issues. And I'm like, wow, there's a lot that's not being followed. And we're going to see it being talked about in the next decade. It's going to take a long time to account for, I think.
Yeah, I keep hearing Tracy come back to the idea of, you know, if only we had been offered an online learning option, and that would have been the solution to almost, you know, so many of my problems. I would have been able to, you know, still have my older daughters with me, because it would just be the standard that they would be home from school. And it's appalling to me that we were not offered that option. And my daughter said the other day, like, what I would like for Christmas is to be able to come stay with you again. And I said, well, what I would like for Christmas would be to have a viable online learning option and to have the schools be closed, because I fear I'm going to be right about January. I fear they're going to come back, and, you know, all those well-intentioned people who are like, oh, just one family gathering over the holidays, there's going to be another huge surge. And I'm not putting myself at risk for that. I've already made too many sacrifices and completely eroded my sense of self by never having time to myself to do anything other than work crappily. that, like, I can't now put myself at risk of a disease that I truly think will impair my life. So now I just have to, like, stay the course indefinitely with this incompetent government at the helm.
Not having the choice to say, oh, here's a great online learning option, we're going to go for that because that works. Just having the choice of crappily working and crappily homeschooling for the first time, not, you know, and just giving it our all, or sending my child to school where there may or may not be COVID cases and we may or may not have to be tested 4 times in the past 4 months. And gosh, does a 6-year-old hate having a COVID test up his nose? Yeah, just having a government that hasn't even tried to instill, to create an online learning option that works for working parents is pretty frustrating. You know, I was like, but you had 4 months of observing what was going on here. Like, we saw the cases climb in schools. And I feel like nothing is being done, or is everything just stuck in some kind of planning stage? And by the time it's finished, you know, in 2022, we'll all be vaccinated. I don't know.
And what really bugs me is the messaging that keeps getting sent out about the best place for children's mental health is in schools. And you know what? If the school context was exactly the same, and even then, like, I know many, many children who, it was, even before COVID, this was not the best place for their mental health, through bullying, through lots of different reasons. But there was an article the other day, and I also know it just from anecdotally from friends of mine who are teachers, that there are some classes, like in elementary schools and high schools, where they could have 5 different substitute teachers in one day. So this is not good for children's mental health. I remember I was tutoring a friend of mine's son. This was many, many years ago. He failed his grade 10 history class, and he's a bright kid. He had three different teachers that year. That's why he failed. So can you imagine, this is happening every day for a lot of teachers, for a lot of students. They feel the stress of their teachers. As teachers, we model everything. So if I'm constantly telling my students, did you wash your hands? Oh, watch your mask. I'm modeling, there's stuff I need to worry about. You know, like that. I'm modeling, oh, no, things still aren't okay. It's not for children's mental health. It's not because, you know, the children are now behind because they missed all that school and they weren't tested in the spring and now we have to catch up. There's no catching up happening. It's not because of that. It is primarily, it's child care, and they will not admit it. Pretending that this is school as normal, I resent that message.
You can't see my nodding on radio, but everything that Tracy's saying, I'm just like emphatically agreeing. And I was reading in the New York Times the other day an article about like what will become of this generation of toddlers who do not have other toddlers to play with because they're home from daycare. And what came from that was largely like they need security in their caregivers. They need to feel stable and loved, and they don't need caregivers who have short tempers and who are hostile and resentful. And I'm like, well, therein lies the challenge.
Well, this is the thing, you know, some schools have been just fine and some schools haven't. And so somebody who's listening to this conversation could say, well, we've been fine. I haven't been stressed. It's been okay. Whereas if you look at the massive list of schools where there have been COVID cases, I think you could say, well, many parents, that is not their experience. Many parents have had this added stress in their lives. I don't know, at least in Montreal, anyway, that list is a long list.
Something I was talking about with a colleague of mine the other day, her partner works in early childhood education, and she's saying the children who are born now, who are surrounded by people with masks over their faces, we learn emotion as babies and as toddlers through analyzing people's faces, right? And through understanding, like if I hit someone and a person goes, the mouth has a different shape. And so we're not necessarily seeing that, as well as speech. And that's a whole other thing, that like get them to school. They have to be in school. There are many, many layers as to why maybe it's not the best place, you know? And I agree with you, like what you said earlier, Robin, there are some people who are very, very happy that their children are in school. They're socializing with their friends to a certain extent. At least they're seeing them. We know that there's no distancing. I mean, they are socializing with their friends. There's no distancing in the class, in the schools. There are no bubbles. Between Gina and myself and you as well, Robin, like we haven't had great experiences with what is happening in the schools and with our own experience just with government decisions and how it's impacting our lives. And for other people, there could be way more positive experiences. I know that there are some schools who are dealing with this really, really well, and other schools who just can't because there's just too many kids and not enough teachers. I know for myself in adult education, part of my job is professional development with teachers, and I'm supposed to be offering much more of it than I am. Part of it is teachers just can't deal, like, it's just too much. Don't give me something else to do, you know, as a teacher. But part of it is also, if I offer PD, there is no one to replace them in the classroom. It's, well, either you teach your students or they have an afternoon off because you're doing professional development. It's tough.
Yes, there are so many things this conversation could touch on. It's massive because it's part of this grand system that we live in, you know, and when one thing changes, it affects everything else. Everything else changes. The whole experience changes. Thanks so much for being a part of this revisiting of our conversation from August. A lot of things have changed since the start of school, and a lot of people's feelings have changed. Some people have taken their kids out of school. Some people have left their kids in school, but we've all, you know, definitely experienced a lot of things this semester that we wouldn't in a normal school year, that's for sure.
Thank you so much, Robin, for revisiting this. I think for myself as well, it was really helpful to, you know, think back on the conversation we had back in August and see, okay, how have things changed and I think the underlying kind of sentiment is things haven't changed. You know, it's still the same feelings of what's going on and why do we not have the choice?
Except now we know more. Now we know. We are fully in the second wave. And so it's why is nobody heeding these numbers? But I do appreciate getting to see you both again, too, and to have the conversation.
Thanks so much. Have a good evening. Happy holidays.
Same to you all. Good luck. Stay as healthy as possible.
Yes. Thanks so much.
That was a conversation with fellow parents Tracy and Gina, who are also teachers as well. And if you'd like to send us a message about that conversation or anything, you can look at our Facebook page, which is CKUT-InTheMotherhood. Or you can send us an email at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. Up next is my conversation with the artistic director and artistic advisor of Bach Before Bedtime. And we're talking about Bach Before Bedtime's Made in Montreal virtual The Nutcracker, which you can find out more about on Bach Before Bedtime's website. And here's that conversation right now.
I'm speaking with two of the people involved with Bach Before Bedtime's virtual production of The Nutcracker. I'm speaking with Bach Before Bedtime artistic director Dorothy Fieldman Freyberg and Bach Before Bedtime's artistic advisor Emily Blunt. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I would like to hear, before we get into talking about the virtual Nutcracker that you've produced and that people can watch, I'd like to know a little bit of background about Bach Before Bedtime, namely when it was created and what inspired you to create it for families, for a family audience.
Well, I started Bach Before Bedtime 11 years ago. It comes under the umbrella of the Allegra Foundation. And we have the Allegra Chamber Music Series, which is an adult chamber concert series. And we do 6 free concerts a year. And I wanted to bring chamber music to children. And the important thing for me about it was bringing children to the hall, not to bring it to schools, but to have an interactive chamber music program. We do them both at Place des Arts and at McGill. We reach about 4,000 children a year. Most of the concerts have whimsical stories. They're interactive. Children have a chance to come up and conduct the musicians, sing songs, dance. And at the end of the concert, they join us with percussion instruments that they either bring or we give them. And then at the very end, they get to meet the musicians and see the instruments and talk. So they have the whole experience of listening to chamber music with a whimsical story. We've done programs with an acrobat. We've done books with authors reading them. We've done Pajama Day at the Opera, doing excerpts from the Magic Flute with opera singers. And everything stopped last March due to COVID. We decided to start with BBB, Bach Before Bedtime Virtual.
For me, Bach Before Bedtime was so wonderful because to be able to bring kids to the hall and not have to worry about them needing to go to the bathroom, them wanting to ask questions in the middle of it. Because if you bring a 5-year-old or a 3-year-old to the symphony, it's a stressful situation for most of us. You know, you want them to be quiet. You can't, it's more stressful than it is fun for some, depending on the child, of course. But Bach Before Bedtime offered a space where that stress felt relieved.
Absolutely. That's why we have small spaces. It's very intimate. And they really are in touch with the performers all the time. That's the difference between going to a symphony concert and going to a chamber music concert. And we've used wind quintets, string quartets, and combinations of both strings and winds in the concerts.
I love that intimate feeling, even as an adult concert goer. But as a child, it's so nice to be close to the instruments, close to the players, and it's naturally amplified. They're not hearing it through speakers, you know. So
that's right.
Yeah. So the question is, how does that translate to the virtual sphere with the Nutcracker? How did you make that happen?
What we did was we decided to do the Nutcracker for the holiday season. And we still wanted it to be interactive. So the Nutcracker is the performance of the Nutcracker with string quartet, dancers. We have animation throughout for the interactive parts. So for the singing, it's interactive. For the conducting, it's interactive. And for the dancing, their voiceovers. It's really a magical performance. wouldn't you say, Emily?
Yeah, like I think for the interactive part, we tried to pick places throughout the show to sort of break that fourth wall that they call it. You know, we have people looking directly at the camera. We have animated characters inviting the children to participate. The narration speaks directly to the children at points. You know, it's telling the story, but at other times it's saying, you know, like, are you dancing with us? Are you singing with us? Yes, we really try and break down that fourth wall like we do in the concerts, of saying, you know, like, there is no difference between audience and performer. Like, we can all interact together.
Is there going to be a chance for kids to ask questions or, you know, respond?
It's actually a film concert, film. So it was released 37 minutes ago. It is officially out in the world and ready.
Congratulations.
People are potentially watching it as we speak. So yeah, I mean, they're in their home. They can be just as loud as they are in the concert hall if they wish and participate as much. And they're welcome to reach out to us with anything ever. We're always around, always available.
Parents can pause or the kids can pause.
They can stop there, get ready to dance, and continue on. I think one other important thing is that this is bilingual. So the voiceovers are all in French and English.
And the other great thing is, I know I have young nieces and nephews who, when they love something, they get obsessed and they want to watch it, you know, the same episode of something 100 times. And so if you purchase a Nutcracker, you own it, which means you can watch it as many times as you want. Yeah. For all those kids that love to do that.
That's great. So I'm wondering what a little bit about how you adapted the Nutcracker, which is a grand spectacle, for the smaller screen, and who was involved in this adaptation?
Both Emily and I adapted it. There is a string quartet version of the Nutcracker that we used. So two violins, viola, cello, and we condensed the story and brought it down to 30 minutes. So it's not too long. And it's just a perfect amount of time to keep their attention and get an overview of the whole story.
Wonderful. I love it. I love a 30-minute Nutcracker.
Yeah, that's like, you know, you love to see the Nutcracker at Christmas time. And obviously we can't do that this year. But also like taking, like you said earlier, like taking a three-year-old to a three-hour production of the Nutcracker, although it seems fun at the outset, maybe it's not, you know, time. 3 hours is a long time.
Yeah. Well. And what is there? So you mentioned animators, so there's the string quartet to watch, and then there are a few other players going on.
Well, what they're going to see is they're going to see the musicians. The musicians are on stage. The dancers are on stage, so they'll see both the dancers and the musicians fading in and out during the whole production.
So there's always action.
Right. And when it comes time for their sing-along, we have it animated. We have the words on the screen. We invite them to join us. So it's animated for them to join, to sing along, to read the words, or the parents to read the words and sing with them. Okay. And with the conducting episode, we have an animated conductor, plus one of the dancers is conducting the children as well during that episode. We invite them all to join us in dancing, and the dancers dance along with them. And you see the dancers and the musicians and the interplay with them.
I mean, my experience of the Nutcracker with children is kids love watching what's going on stage, but they don't always follow the story.
Right.
So it sounds like you've really targeted that kid audience and that family audience.
Yes, we really tried to do that. That's why we have the voiceovers just signaling what's going on. Fritz and Clara are opening presents. You know, they arrive at the land of the sweets, the sugar plum fairy. So they're guided through the whole performance.
What do you think that kids and families are going to come away from this with? I mean, for me, I'm like, I think some people don't even know the story of the Nutcracker. So some parents will be like, oh, that's what that was about. Okay.
That's and right.
I learned the story, some of the parts of the Nutcracker as when we wrote this show. We actually did the show live last year. And it was a huge success. So that's why we decided to start BBB Virtual this season with it. I think we're just hoping that maybe people will have some joy. It's, you know, it's really hard. We're not getting together with our families, you know, like it's been a long year. And so hopefully it's just something that you can have with your family, or if you're watching it at a daycare or whatever, and just have 30 minutes of fun, maybe feel like something's normal for a bit. Mm-hmm. You're still getting your Nutcracker.
I think it's a very joyous, happy production. I really do. And I think that they'll want to watch it many times, especially when they have that interactive part. They can sing again, they can dance again, they can conduct again. And they're watching ballet. They're being introduced to ballet. They're being introduced to chamber music, which is something that's very important to me. So you're not hearing it with a full orchestra and you're far from the stage. It's intimate. They're very close to the musicians and dancers. It's almost like they're on stage with them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I watched the trailer and that's what I felt.
Oh, good.
There was not very much distance they weren't risen up on a stage. They were right there.
That's the goal, to make it close and intimate.
And also I was thinking about, well, I could have it on while I'm making dinner or something. And I can Correct. Still hear the beautiful music, you know, Right. while my kid is watching the production.
Yeah.
Because I love the music of the Nutcracker.
Oh, it's so beautiful. Oh. You know, you really can never hear it enough.
Yes, exactly. On repeat. Yeah.
At this time of year, I'm all for it. Turn it on. It's wonderful. So let's hear from you. Where can people go to find this and download it? Online.
So they can go to our website, bachbeforebedtime.com, and right there on the front page is a link to purchase it. It's $15. And then once you purchase it, you will get a receipt in your email where you can either download the video directly to your computer and have it there forever and ever, or you can actually stream it right on the website, or you can do both. So if you want to watch it immediately, you can click the download, it can start downloading, and you can watch it, you can stream it from our website directly.
And I think it's important for people to know that this is an original production that you Yes. created. And to me, $15, that's a steal, considering Right. how much tickets cost to go to Place des Arts to watch the Nutcracker.
Another part of our mission is making music accessible to everyone. Like, we won't want to price anyone out of an experience like this. Everyone deserves to have this experience. So $15, yeah, it's not much. And you're supporting at least 10, if not 15 local Montreal artists who have had a rough year trying to find work and everything. We had, you know, 5 camera crew, 2 dancers, 5 musicians, Dorothy and myself. It's 100% local, everything done here. Yeah.
So supporting Montreal arts and culture.
Yeah.
In this season, $15. Yeah. I'm like, buy 3.
And it's a great gift. I mean, this is a perfect gift. Christmas gift, Hanukkah gift, birthday gift, whatever. Gift of music.
There is a gift option too. I believe when you go on the form that you can, there's a little like gift box that you can click and then you can gift it to people.
Okay. And you can give it to anybody anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
We've already had people purchasing it from the rest of Canada, some people in the States. Yeah. We're very excited about that.
Yeah. A little bit of Montreal culture in your email on Christmas Day or, you know, anytime during the holidays, New Year's Day. Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with me. It's been great.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Robin. This has been very nice.
Bye. Okay.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Thanks for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This has been In the Motherhood for December 16th. We'll be back in January. Again, if you'd like to know more about Bach Before Bedtime, you can go to bachbeforebedtime.com and you can find out how to easily download their film version of The Nutcracker, which is for kids and families. It's $15 digital download. You'll have access to it forever once it's released, or it is released now. It was released yesterday, December 15th. And so I invite you to do that. It's a fun virtual holiday classic. Thanks for listening to CKUT 90.3 FM and In the Motherhood.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to your weekly news show about Africa with briefings and analysis from the continent. Amandla has been on the air now for over 30 years, and we're very pleased to be able to keep going in this time of COVID and bringing you more news and more information and more analysis about what's happening on the continent. This week, Gwen, what have we got going? Rashid, Firoz has once again pulled another one of his brilliant coups here.
Okay, yes. So, yes, we're going to be taking a look at a book that Diraja Press just published in collaboration with the Transnational Institute called Region and Revolt, Mapping the Recent Uprisings in North Africa and West Asia. So we'll be bringing some of the voices that contributed to that book to the air tonight.
That's great. Thanks a lot. So stay tuned to Amandla.